Welcome to The Exploits of Play, a podcast about the strange and unexpected roles of games and play in our age of capitalism that just keeps getting weirder. My name is Max Haven. I'm Canada Research Chair in the Radical Imagination.
I'm Hallie Frost with the platform Weird Economies, and we're presenting this podcast. Today, our interview is with Hugh Davies. Hugh Davies is an artist, curator, and researcher working across digital media, academic scholarship, and creative practice. He explores the social, cultural, and political dimensions of art and technology. He's written two books on game culture and ethnographies of play, and is currently a research fellow with a focus on Chinese platform studies at RMIT in Melbourne. We interviewed Hugh about his article, The Gamification of Conspiracy Theory, QAnon as Alternate Reality Game. Max, can you tell us a little bit more about how you came into contact with Hugh's work and why we're having him on the cast today?
Yeah. Hugh's work was introduced to me by our mutual colleague, Alina Chia, who teaches at Goldsmiths University. When Alina learned that I and some of my collaborators had been becoming increasingly curious about and also making a game about QAnon, the conspiracy fantasy that began in the United States and has spread worldwide. Hugh had also been doing a lot of research and, as he reveals in the interview, became quite fascinated with QAnon and the strange culture that emerged from it as a kind of alternate reality game. And I'll describe what an alternate reality game is in a second. But for those listeners who somehow are not aware of QAnon, it is a kind of meta conspiracy fantasy believed by millions of people around the world. By some estimates, if it were classified as a religion, it would be the fourth or fifth most popular religion in the United States. And it basically holds that there is a conspiracy of sort of blue chip CEOs and A-list celebrities and very well-known politicians who are running a secret conspiracy to abduct, torture, and steal the bodily fluids of children. And the QAnon conspiracy fantasy, and I'm using that term from the work of a very fascinating thinker named Wu Ming Wan, who wrote an excellent book in Italian called The QAnon Conspiracy. He makes a distinction between a conspiracy fantasy and a conspiracy theory. And he says that QAnon is a conspiracy fantasy because it kind of brings together dozens and dozens of conspiracy theories from throughout Western history and combines them into a kind of super fantasy or meta fantasy that increasingly involves anyone and everyone that people can think of. Now, when this conspiracy fantasy first began to circulate on the internet in more mainstream circles, a number of game designers started to speak out that the way in which this conspiracy fantasy functioned looked a lot like an alternate reality game. The QAnon conspiracy fantasy circulates around this mysterious person, codenamed Q, who travels the nether regions of the internet, sharing strange cryptic messages about this horrible conspiracy. And apparently, Q is a secret agent, or was a secret agent, within the Trump government doing holy battle with the evil conspiracists. And what this looked like increasingly to alternate game designers was something that they would create. And Hugh has designed alternate games for a couple of decades now and was really thinking about this in this interview and in his work. So briefly, an alternate reality game is a game that people play not just sitting around a table, you know, with a board and cards, not just a role-playing game where you choose a character and you pretend to be them, but actually something, it's a sort of game that you play with real-world elements. So some examples of this might be people who go around the neighborhood and look for various items or find and leave each other clues in neighborhoods. The game that Hugh is going to talk about is one that he developed to try and think through conspiracy theories in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. There are games that you basically play inside of reality and that kind of change you and fellow players' perceptions and engagements with reality. So Hugh, in this interview, is going to speak a little bit about his own history as an alternate reality game designer and how the QAnon conspiracy fantasy and conspiracies more generally and the cultures of paranoia that they introduce are reminiscent of these games and what these games have to teach us about this strange moment we find ourselves in when such conspiracy theories seem to run rampant. So, Hugh, I want to begin by asking you what we ask all of our guests on this podcast, which is to sort of start by giving us an anecdote or telling us a story about an experience of games or play from your childhood or adolescence that you felt like really shaped you. And then sort of walk us forward from that moment of childhood play to the present and what you're researching and thinking about and making today.
I think growing up, hide and seek games were always pretty fun for me, like the physicality of them. I had a friend when I was a kid who had a Commodore 64. And I remember we played The Hobbit, which was a Commodore 64 game, which I actually later learned was designed and made in Melbourne. But it was a text-based game with images. And I think that for me was a bit of a precursor to the kind of games that started to emerge in the 1990s with things like Myst and Riven and those kind of things, where a bit texty, a bit point and clicky, but definitely spatial. I guess with all of these games, they were quite spatial. There was a spatiality to them that I really enjoyed. And even in the 90s, playing things like Doom, just from the idea of like sort of moving through space, which to me was sort of always a lot more interesting than the sort of shooting part of them. And when I went to university, I didn't go into university until my late 20s, and I studied sculpture and was always sort of very interested in space and architecture and spatial practice. And I'd worked in film and television before going to university, and I was always very interested in screen space because a lot of what I had done as a sculptor before going to university was actually sort of doing scenography, like making props and sets. And this idea of making physical objects that would only be seen in a screen space, this idea of the spatiality of the screen, I think was always very interesting to me. And when I finished studying sculpture, I kind of exhibited for a while, and then I ended up studying media design. And so that kind of led me pretty seamlessly into games and into making games. But for me, games were never just sort of entirely digital. They always had this sort of physical element to them as well. And so when getting into games, the first thing that really sort of inspired me was pervasive games and things like the work of Blast Theory at that time. And some of the theatre groups, things like Forced Entertainment, this idea of sort of like gamic and playable space as performative and physical and pervasive, and games as expansive and not just restricted to the screen, but the fact that, you know, play itself is pervasive and so are games. And, you know, games are, of course, a potent metaphor for anything in the world. And so these ideas all sort of blurring. And I guess that was around sort of the first decade of the 2000s was really just sort of exploring a lot of those ideas in how games complicated physical and digital space. I'd kind of been knocking around in pervasive and alternate reality games from around 2004, 2005 onwards. And it was sort of like an extension of like kids' games in a lot of ways. Physical treasure hunts. And I had the opportunity, I think it was like 2006, I flew over to Come Out and Play Festival in New York, where I was presenting some of my own kind of playable practice. Ian Bogost and Jay McGonigal had a game that was being played as part of Come Out and Play, and I was presenting something in the Conflux Festival there, Festival of Psychogeography, that was happening at the same time. And that was a really fascinating kind of like global moment where a whole lot of people got together. You know, mobile phones had just sort of been out for about 10 years, but smartphones hadn't been released and wouldn't be for another sort of year or two, but they were kind of on the tips of everyone's tongue, the idea that, you know, phones were going to be really important in terms of playable space. So, and alternate reality games were like featured as part of that event. And I had made a couple, and I just sort of really felt like, oh yeah, wow, these are a very important body of practice. So when I got back to Australia, I continued making them just sort of at a very kind of like local and domestic scale. And then in 2008, sorry, in 2009, I studied a PhD studying alternate reality games. So games, which I should sort of give a bit of a de definition to, alternate reality games, games that are a little bit without limits, which is to say they typically begin in internet spaces, which is to say, you know, that the internet will set out how to get into a game, like invite you into a rabbit hole or something like that, give you a clue, you identify what's sort of ostensibly a hidden clue, and that might lead you to clues in the real world. And I guess the A couple of the key defining features of alternate reality games is that expansiveness. Probably the biggest thing is that they deliberately try and blur the line between what is game and what is real life, more than most experiences. And, you know, that sort of raises a whole lot of red flags. But I think that edginess was what really was a lot of their appeal at the end, in that period, this idea that, you know, you could create these experiences that were a little bit boundaryless. I suppose as well, what they inadvertently did was pointed to the gameness and the playfulness of all of everyday life by sort of introducing this gameness to things. So I began studying them as part of my PhD, and I was really interested in the work of a lot of kind of like US and Canadian designers, predominantly, and people like Jane McGonigal, who had done her own PhD on alternate reality games, or ubiquitous games as she called them. And I was really interested in what often gets called the first alternate reality game, which was The Beast, which had taken place in the year 2000 as part of the movie AI, artificial intelligence. What appealed to me most of all out of that was the online community that formed around that, which was a whole lot of groups of collective detectives and problem solvers, people who only knew each other through online spaces, who assembled online to solve the puzzle of that game. I don't really know that we know accurate numbers around how many there were, but I think we can say thousands in that there were distinct groups. And when the game wound up in, I think it was July 2001, there was this sense of inertia in a lot of these groups because they'd devoted all of this time and skill and collective energy into solving this huge alternate reality game puzzle. And on the other side of the curtain, so to speak, the people who were making the game, people at Microsoft, they had also been furiously making the game ad hoc because they built this whole game and it was solved, I think, within the first 3 days or something of them publishing it. And they're like, oh no, this wasn't supposed to happen. So they had to completely build this game a few steps ahead of the people playing it. It was information which was found on the internet, in online spaces, but also found in physical spaces. And it was clues and sort of answering mysterious phone calls and faxes and getting information. And it required sort of deep knowledge in a whole lot of different directions. The idea being that no one person would have been able to solve the whole thing, that teams needed to assemble. We were all as players and designers, and typically the two went in hand, people who were players would go on and make their own games, and people who designed them would play others. But this community, and there was a community of cloud makers, one of the communities who had been involved in this game called themselves the Cloud Makers. And 2 months after the game had wound up and 9/11 happened, there was a small amount of discussion on the forum about should we apply our skills as collective detectives to this horrific act. And I should caveat this by saying, because I've spoken about this before and other people have as well, and people who are in that community haven't enjoyed that that has become their legacy. With all of the work that they did, there are a couple of kind of errant posts in their forum discussing should we apply our skills to this terrible event. And I mean, the self-appointed moderators in the forum shut down that thinking fairly quickly. But for a lot of people, and myself included, it really kind of like preempts a lot of the things that we have now. people will quickly say QAnon, but I would also say Bellingcat. I would also say things like WikiLeaks. A whole lot of these movements of applying collective discovery skills to real world crises. That particular moment was really sort of at the thrust of a lot of my PhD, was exploring how people had come to that idea. And I suppose more than anything, the sort of perceived agency in a kind of gamification context. And so in my PhD, I did a lot of study and writing around that. And I made my own game, which launched 10 years after 9/11 to the day. And that game had presented an alternate history of the past 10 years, following on what would have happened if a group like that had sought to solve the mystery of the 9/11 attacks. And in creating that game, I didn't really need to make any content. All I really did was make sort of like a front-end website, which every week represented a year. And I just had some sort of discussion narrative between some players, which the players of my game could uncover. But more than anything, it just pointed to existing conspiracy theories, of which there was just such an explosion, as you'll remember, of conspiracy theories.
So in your academic work and also in your work as a game designer, you've been thinking a lot about the connection between alternate reality games and conspiracy theories. I wonder if you can unpack that a little bit for us as we move towards the subject that we really want to get to in this podcast, which is QAnon and the politics of conspiracy and play in this moment.
I was a bit concerned in creating this game because I didn't want to create more conspiracy theories. But I guess the key point is that, and we, you know, we're sort of drifting into conspiracy theory here, but one thing I've noticed about conspiracy theories is that they have a bit of a lifespan, which is to say a conspiracy really kind of has traction for like maybe 2 years. And then it just sort of starts to dissolve in the face of competing conspiracy theories, or the people who get caught up in it kind of drift off into something else or one thing and another. And I'd seen that previously with conspiracy theories. And I wasn't quite sure if that would be the same online because, as I've talked about in a lot of places, you know, the internet is perfect for conspiracies. It is a conspiracy theory through the internet. Everything is connected. But after 10 years or after a sort of 8 years of watching the conspiracy theories about 9/11, everything had sort of shifted. The whole mood of not just sort of the US, but the world had really changed and done quite an about turn in terms of conspiratorial thinking about 9/11 and the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan. So I think it's fair to say that they had lost their flavor. Is probably a fairly accurate way of putting it, where people were aware that there were all of these conspiracy theories, but they'd very much just sort of become part of the landscape. So what my own game did was just pointed to all of these conspiracy theories. So players of my game would be revisiting all of these conspiracy theories that already existed. But of course, to a lot of people, it was all familiar territory because I wasn't actually creating any more conspiracy theories. I was just pointing to all of the ones that existed. So the reasoning for me, the reason I wanted to create the game, was to really sort of critique the idea of gamification, which was really gathering traction at that time. This idea of kind of gamifying work or things in the real world. And as sort of like, you know, an effective labor or management technique or whatever, which to me at that time and still today just seemed horrifying. And so I wanted to point to the problems with that. And I thought those problems had been really kind of like beautifully illustrated a decade earlier in the idea of, you know, what if we gamify discovering who the attackers of 9/11 are? And yeah, I think the moderators did a really good thing in closing it down because I think it was a nightmare problem to begin with. And, you know, I think the people that would have played that game probably would have ended up in like Guantanamo or something like that. You know what I mean? I just think that it was quite a dangerous exercise to be undertaking. And so for my own game, I really wanted to target people in the alternate reality games community to have this conversation about gamifying real world tragedy and gamification in general. So what I did was I posted a whole lot of them, a whole lot of these players, and I managed to get hold of them through sites like Unfiction. And I knew a lot of these people as well, just through having met them in person more online. And I posted them floppy disks and zip disks with clues on them, like with photos and then with time-coded information embedded into photos and handwritten notes in Urdu and Arabic and Chinese dialects and one thing and another, knowing that, again, no one was going to be able to solve all of these things individually, but collectively people would be able to sort of begin putting clues together, which they did. And the game sort of made, I think it went on to Unfiction, which was the sort of ARG site at the time. I don't even know if Unfiction still exists, to be honest, but there was a discussion around it there. There was also discussions in another forum. And each week I would update the Darkest Puzzle site to represent sort of another year passing. So for 10 years, so it went for 10 weeks. And there was no resolution at the end, no sort of, oh, this is who did it, or this is how you solve the game. It really was just a way of getting people to engage with the conspiracy theories or the kind of the conspiracy play that had already taken place around 9/11. And ideally to sort of provoke a bit of a critical discussion of gamification and of alternate reality games. And that did happen. A couple of people came out pretty angry about the game, which I thought was good, and I thought they made really valid criticisms. It was a weird moment, though, as well, I have to say, by which I mean alternate reality games at that point, as a genre, had sort of fallen away. They were very exciting and new, probably from about, I don't know, 2004 until about 2008, 2009. By about 2010 or 2011, I think they'd just sort of gotten a little bit passé. They just had lost a lot of their momentum, and the whole terminology around them had changed. All the nomenclature was different. A lot of concerns had been raised about them. I mean, I was one of the people raising those concerns that they were a form of play that was available to essentially sort of like an upper middle class that had the time and had the technology to engage with them, that it was mostly kind of white people in Europe and the US and Canada and Australia who were really able to engage. And I tried to destabilize some of that in my own game by, you know, deliberately distributing information in Urdu and in Chinese and in Arabic and in languages outside of what this ARG community were sort of traditionally operating in, sort of like the languages that people were usually kind of given to decode were like programming languages. Yeah, they generally sort of were based in the US, like there'd be telephone booths ringing in different places in the US or in Canada or in Australia. And I sort of made a point of hiding clues in Istanbul and Shanghai and Mexico City and I suppose outside of those centers, because I sort of wanted more than anything people to kind of realize there was a larger world of people not engaging in these experiences. But as I say, it was a weird moment because the interest in these games had begun to die away and other things were becoming more interesting and other modes of play. Pervasive games were starting. Mobile gaming had become much bigger because, of course, you know, iPhones had been released and that changed everything.
Right. Okay. So before we get to QAnon and the idea that QAnon in some ways is an alternate reality game or somehow appropriates some of the techniques of an alternate reality game. I wonder if you could just walk us through how we get from this kind of early days of alternate reality gaming that you've already described to the moment when QAnon sort of emerges onto the global stage. And I wonder especially if you could talk a little bit about the role of gender in this movement, and specifically sort of take us by way of the Gamergate scandal, which occurred, which saw sort of male gamers take umbrage at what they imagined to be a feminist conspiracy to undermine masculine game culture, and the way that this enfolded a kind of dark or sadistic play with these kind of patriarchal and conspiratorial tropes as well.
In this sort of period between my own game and QAnon, I was quite concerned about the militarization of alternate reality games. And I suppose there were sort of like festering discussions around the ethics of alternate reality games at this time. A lot of kind of rationale had come in and different modes of thinking about accessibility and race and gender and ethnicity and all of these sort of things had come into that kind of ARG space, which was all really important and really welcome, like a bit more diverse thinking around these games. And also between 2010 and 2015, the Snowden papers were released. And one of the things that came out of that was that a military contractor had looked at how various game types could be applied in military contexts. And there was a whole section on alternate reality games, which was really fascinating to read, and how video games and alternate reality games could be used in propagandic settings, and people could be sort of like tricked into doing things through alternate reality games that they might not normally do. And it was quite interesting just to see, because a few people had sort of speculated, wow, these could really be used in sort of like, you know, military training context, because, you know, alternate reality games, a lot of the skills that they really sort of culture and nurture are kind of spycraft. It is really sort of like decoding information and sharing information. And, you know, there's sort of all these elements of secrecy and conspiracy, one thing and another. And also around that time, the game Cicada came out, which was this alternate reality game that had all of these sort of like bizarre puzzles that you had to solve. And a whole lot of people were saying, you know, is this sort of like a basic training to become like a CIA recruit or IDF kind of like, you know, like, to be honest, I don't even know where Cicada landed. There was a US journalist who contacted me a few years ago and really wanted to discuss Cicada and alternate reality games. But around that time, and I'm talking sort of 2015, 2016, there was kind of like a bit of an emergence of these deeply secretive alternate reality games. So alternate reality games that were just sort of like kicking around in online spaces. They tended not to have much to do with the real world. They really were just sort of online games. And they traded in conspiracy theories more than anything, which was not atypical for alternate reality games. But yeah, this sort of genre of alternate reality games, and of course, you know, like a lot of them appeared in 4chan and 8chan, as I discuss in my article. There was a whole lot of precursors to QAnon in those spaces, FBI Anon, CIA Anon, that just sort of like put out these conspiracy theories and then invited people to do the research, to look into them. And these were quite familiar to me because, I mean, that's kind of what my own game had done in with The Darkest Puzzle, was like created the sort of slightly provocative idea or narrative and then invited people to look at the existing research in these spaces. And I don't want to ascribe any agency to one individual or group of individuals or for any of these things. I think with all of this stuff, it's quite sort of zeitgeisty. It was just, the time was right. It was kind of on everyone's lips. It really was it's where online culture was at that moment. there were these sorts of conspiracies milling around in different spaces that, you know, some of them were game spaces, some of them were not game spaces. Certainly 4chan and 8chan. I mean, you know, in 2014, you had this Gamergate movement. Gamergate was, I think, very much sort of a conspiracy theory in terms of there are a whole lot of predominantly male gamers and people who had kind of, like the gaming space had been groomed to be very male from really the mid-1980s until that time. And it had some really sort of hyper-masculine injections with games like Doom and I suppose sort of like the whole first-person shooter genre. And games were promoted in pretty sexist and misogynistic ways for really sort of the best part of like 20 years or even 30 years from 94 to 2014. And there are so many things that we can point to from like game booth girls, like girls who would be sort of scantily clad and appear at game events sort of draped over cars, and this very sexualized portrayal of video games. It was very much embraced by the industry. And I mean, you know, these things have a real kind of key history as well. You know, I mean, after the games crash of 1984 and the Nintendo console comes into sort of, you know, it's described in heroic terms now of how Nintendo saved the video games market with their consoles. But being Nintendo and being Japanese products and being toys, as they were considered, it was a decision needed to be made. Well, if they're toys, if we're not going to sell them in electronic stores all the time and we want to sell them in department stores, where do we put them? And so it was decided, well, we should put them in the toy aisle. But then it's like, well, do we put them in the blue aisle or do we put them in the pink aisle? And so it was decided we should put them in the blue aisle in about 1984. Because, of course, you know, you had all of these different games, and a lot of them were shooter games. And so it was like, well, shooting is a boys' thing, so we put them in the boys' aisle. And that sort of, you know, like, sort of minor decision had really kind of major long-term ramifications of how games were designed and played and made and celebrated and written about for a long time. And Gamergate was this moment where you had a whole group of people reacting to a really sort of small event, which was, you know, it came down to sort of like a breakup of a couple who were both involved in game playing and game making. And this misogynistic backlash against the idea that games were being played by people other than kind of white men and men in general, or people that identify as men. And this is a fairly simplistic kind of papering over of like a really kind of large and pretty terrible event. But I mean, it really was a pretty awful spotlight to be shown on games culture, because it really did just sort of portray the outcome of all of these sorts of ways of marketing and making games for a really long time. It really had sort of like cultivated a pretty dark group of players who, yeah, really just saw video games as male spaces. So, yeah, Gamergate was really that just sort of spilling out into the real world. That was a conspiracy theory that progressive forces were trying to kind of like wokeify video games, were trying to like take the edgy, misogynistic elements out of them without realizing that there are a lot of women and a lot of people who didn't identify as men, and a lot of people of color and a lot of people all over the world from all ages who've been playing video games the whole time. It's just that they've mostly been marketed toward men. I think it's really kind of important as well, like, I suppose, just from like a media archaeologist and internet historian point of view, like all of this stuff is sort of coming into being at this time as well, you know, like the idea of doxing people and of finding out about people online and digging up information, going back through people's sort of, Twitter accounts and Facebook accounts years and years and years to see, who they were and what they'd said and what they'd done and how their politics had changed or hadn't changed. And as well as sort of like, I suppose, starting up a whole lot of fake accounts as well, creating troll armies of just, a whole series of accounts to sort of, you make a post and then all of these people like it, but the people who all like it are actually you just across a whole lot of different accounts that you've created. This sort of online shenanigans, which, we're still really only in the first 30 years of online. We're still coming up with new ideas and things. And I suppose at that 2014, 2015 moment of Gamergate, a lot of this trolling and doxing was really sort of finding itself, I think is probably a good way of putting it. Some of the really dark aspects of the internet were really kind of forming in very kind of like, unique and terrible ways. And these communities were finding each other as well. These people who, you had armies of isolated, quite often male game players who felt that there was a conspiracy against them to take away their quite masculine gameplay experiences and to make them politically correct. And not only did they reject that, but they found each other as a process, in the process of rejecting that. So these huge communities formed of, sort of these troll armies, and they began to move, that began to conglomerate in spaces. And of course, 4chan really was one of those spaces. Some of the worst aspects of internet culture really kind of lived in those spaces and thrived and festered in those spaces. Of course, the Christchurch shooting, which happened in 2019, a politically incorrect forum in 4chan might have closed at that time, and then they all went across to 8chan. I think that was how the history went. But suffice to say, there were these forums where some pretty hard right, alt-right, a fairly colourful rogues gallery of these personalities were hanging out and spending time with each other, and ideas were being shared and tactics were being shared. And these were game spaces. These were gamers who had felt jilted by the real world. What they thought was their domain alone, that video games was very much theirs. It turned out video games were everyone's, in what is now called the game century, and games are not just sort of for this exclusive group. It's everybody's playing video games, and that was a very difficult learn for these people. And they felt that a culture that was just theirs had been taken away from them. And I mean, I don't know, to a certain extent, it had. They were just wrong in thinking that it was all theirs. But then again, they'd been groomed to think that way. Like, the whole games industry had a vested interest in creating and marketing to them these particular experiences as theirs and theirs alone. So I don't want to sound like I'm giving too much sympathy to them, but I can see how they perceive themselves as victims, I think is probably a good way of putting it. And so, in these spaces where the edginess that they wanted, the sort of political incorrectness that they loved about their games, the fact that you could just shoot and rape and do terrible things in first-person shooter games, that kind of rhetoric and logic was expressed in those online spaces. And also this sort of like political disenchantment with the real world. You have these sort of these groups festering away, and then every now and then they're spilling out into the real world with things like Pizzagate, which, was a conspiracy theory, which I think it actually began in 4chan or 8chan, and then spilled out into the real world. And this is also where kind of like the normification of these spaces occurred, which is to say, they began bleeding out of not just these online spaces, but people began making videos and tweeting and one thing and another. And people who were not part of those communities and didn't have the frame of context that it was a whole lot of gamers playing, essentially, like trolling, playing troll play, and took what they were saying verbatim, and then got really caught up in these ideas and thought that it was true. You know, the conspiracy spilled out into the real world.
Okay, so now it's time to really move to what we really want to talk about today, which is QAnon as an alternate reality game. And you are among those scholars who has really thoughtfully and carefully explored this question of what are the game-like and the darkly playful elements of the QAnon conspiracy fantasy, and how should we understand them through the lens of games and play, and what does that offer us? So I guess I would ask you to maybe, for our listeners who are not as familiar with QAnon, to talk about it a little bit, and also why you and others think it's so important that we understand it through the lens of games and play.
For me, QAnon is an internet conspiracy, but potentially also an alternate reality game. And as with alternate reality games and conspiracy theories, they're not particularly discrete. Just as, you know, a really good conspiracy theory really wants to have some facts woven into it to make it legible and to make it seem as though it's real. Likewise, an alternate reality game does those same things. And alternate reality games embrace conspiracy theories and always have. And conspiracy theories, I would argue, embrace a kind of Luddic logic, like a playfulness. There's a sort of libidinal element with conspiracy theories, and I think always has been, which is to say, once you kind of release yourself from scientific logic, once you let that go, there's a lot of freedom to sort of move about in different directions and really sort of just to get whole areas and stick them and come up with like wild and intuitive conspiracy theories. And we've seen that many times before. You know, we saw it with the 9/11 attacks. We've seen it with conspiracies before and since. We saw it with Pizzagate and Gamergate. And with QAnon, you really had this sort of like quite libidinal conspiracy theory where it started in these online spaces. As I say, I suspect either sort of somewhere between a joke and a game, and then it moved out of these spaces and it was taken out of these spaces. So I think the first step in that process was, so you have a character called Q. So Q is someone anonymously posting and saying they have high level or Q access within the US government. Now, who Q actually is contested and has probably changed several times. Q was posting in the sort of chans for a while. And at some point, Q's posts moved out of the chan spaces, which is to say people started interpreting them and turning them into videos and turning them into tweets and turning them into the larger internet. And they lost all of their edgelord and gamified context in the larger internet. And people sort of started thinking of them as a kind of canon, as a sort of alternate truth. And of course, you know, all this happens against a backdrop of alternate facts and in a post-truth world where truth is already very contested in sort of the American context. So then you have the rise of Q bakers, which are people who get what Q is saying in these little kind of like micro releases of information and interpreting it for a wider audience. So these people, you know, they become influencers, they become interpreters of the Q canon. And so for a lot of people, they're not actually even looking at the original Q tweets. They are just reading the interpretations. So QAnon is not any one of these individual things. It's the whole phenomenon. It's people kind of all the way down the chain interpreting these Q posts and then interpreting the interpretations of the Q posts and so on and so on. And then, of course, once you kind of like fall into one of these echo chambers, once you start like looking at tweets or watching YouTube videos about QAnon information, then of course you have this kind of like algorithmic conspirituality, where the recommendation engine feeds you more and more conspiracy theories, and then you start to get this kind of feeling of synchronicity that, like, yeah, I watched this video and then I saw this other thing about this, and I couldn't help but think the two are connected. And of course, you know, this is how the internet is not just designed, but, like, you know, algorithms are constantly sending us into these echo chambers. So with the kind of normification of QAnon, a whole lot of people who don't really understand the 4chan and 8chan context of QAnon, they don't understand the history of video games and Gamergate and Pizzagate and all the stuff that led up to it, but are just sort of stumbling into these spaces and this sort of thinking, wow, like, a lot of this makes sense. Like, I don't believe what's happening in politics, and this person seems to have political access at the highest level. I don't have that access, but, you know, they seem to be kind of telling the truth, which is sort of, you know, it all has sort of like a resonance and a vibe with what Donald Trump was saying and doing at the time as well, which is, you know, I have political access at a high level when I'm speaking truth about what is happening in those sort of, you know, elite echelons of power.
So I think the really promising thing about your research, not only on QAnon, but on games and games in public space and around public discourse more broadly, I think the really important thing that it offers is a sense that we're ill-served if we imagine that play and games is alien from the major issues and crises of our times. And I think in a lot of your work outside of the work on QAnon, you've pointed out that many of today's political movements and protest movements, both sort of radical and reactionary, both left and right, are increasingly taking on playful and game-like characteristics. And I wonder if you can sort of give us a bit more of a global view of how that's playing out right now and what you see the consequences of that being.
A lot of what we perceive as performances of or nationalism, identity in community, identity individually, I think it's helpful to interpret or even recognize a lot of this stuff as kind of like live action role play from the beginning, that, you know, all kind of elements of identity are kind of performed and are performed playfully. I mean, that's subjectivity, right? You know, it's how we express ourselves. So once you sort of realize that play is a part of not just human, but kind of like living thing subjectivity, you know, most people are familiar with playing with like pets, like cats and dogs and stuff. You know, it's kind of the only language that we share with the animal kingdom. And we can see the personality of our pets and of animals in general, in how they play, in how they perform, in how they express their individuality and subjectivity through this performance of themselves. And I guess that's what play is in a certain respect. It is really a performance of yourself. So when you see kind of like nationalisms as well, I mean, you know, that is a kind of like live action role play of a country or of individuals in a country. And then when you see a protest as well, that is a performance of antagonism. And I think that when I talk about the gamified elements or the play elements, not just of QAnon, but of what happened on January the 6th, I do it very much within a context of looking at activism in real and online spaces and gamified activism in online spaces, which is, you know, sort of a significant part of my own personal research, looking at how the importance of video games in things like the Hong Kong protests in 2019, the Hong Kong protests in 2014, the kind of Israel-Palestine protests of today, in a whole range of activist spaces, games, game logic, game rhetorics, and game symbols appearing. It's the media of the moment. But of course, with games, it's not just a media. It's a way of acting and behaving in the world. It's a performance. It's a play. So, you know, when people stormed the Capitol, a lot of them were caught up in this QAnon thing, which was inherently gamified and playful from the beginning anyway, which is to say, not only had it sprung out of these game spaces where, you know, sort of refugees of video game culture had been hanging out for quite a while. But it was itself kind of like a playful and gamified experience, which is to say, you know, what made QAnon so successful was the fact that people really kind of built their identities around it, which is to say, you know, like bakers and influencers and one thing and another got a following by, you know, got score, got clicks and likes through discussing it and through theorizing it. And so when a lot of these people converged and people who were influenced by these people converged and people who had all sorts of political discontent, and I mean, January the 6th protest began, I think, as like a Stop the Steal protest. And that was sort of something which was very much in the QAnon spaces as well. So there was a lot of these people all together. When they got into the White House, then I think, and I mean, I don't want to kind of gloss over the fact that like six people died, but I think that these people were ill prepared for success. They had no contingency for success. There's a lot of discussion around, oh, you know, some of them brought cable ties. And I think a lot of these people probably brought cable ties to the supermarket. It was part of their identity to wear flak jackets with, you know, open carry kind of like attire. I think if you'd caught them at a barbecue, they probably would have been carrying, you know, zip ties and handcuffs and bulletproof jackets and wearing QC. It's just they're LARPing. That's part of their identity. And, you know, it makes them look and feel tough and aggressive. And, you know, there's probably good reasons why those people want to feel tough and aggressive. You know, they're probably very vulnerable in certain ways. And you know, I recognize like we don't have that same sort of culture in my country, but I don't want to sort of like deny these people their gun culture in an American context. That is like part of American culture. So when they appeared, when they turned up in these, attired in this way, presenting as this way, and I would sort of suggest playing their identities in this way, you storm the White House, you bring guns and zip ties. I mean, people are going to get hurt. That's just, you know, par for the course. But as I say, I don't really think that there was contingencies for success, which is another way of saying I don't actually believe they were there to overthrow the government. I think they were there and, you know, I judge them by their actions. I think they were there to own the libs, to you know, as a show of like, fuck you, as a show of like, we don't care and we can do this if we want and you don't mean anything to us. But they just had no capacity to overthrow the government. I mean, you know, I think someone like, I mean, I don't even know that Donald Trump would have the capacity to kind of like overthrow. He was in government for 4 years. And I mean, I don't really know how much got done. Even Steve Bannon as well. I think, you know, of all of that kind of like, you know, far right political milieu, he seems kind of like maybe the most capable, but I also don't think that he's one to sort of dirty his hands with that kind of thing. I think he's probably more interested in like developing that community and having them sort of, you know, pay for his content and like and share and that kind of thing. I think at heart, he's still a media maker and a producer. We are in kind of like this end time capitalist moment and we're living through kind of a decline of empire. And I think a lot of these things are like pathologies of decline. And sort of broadly speaking, we know things are getting worse. There's a gradual kind of ebbing away. There's like, there's a lot of countries in the world, China where I've just been is one of them, where there's still that feeling of things are much better for me than they were for my parents' generation, and things were much better for my parents' generation than they were for my grandparents' generation, and I know things will be much better for my kids. And we haven't had that for a while in the kind of broader West, I suspect. I don't want to say it universally because it's not true. It's different circumstances for different people. But I think, you know, we can point to across the kind of like, you know, Western hemisphere, I suppose, a declining middle class and a realization that we are at this sort of like end times capitalism where things are just getting more difficult and more scarce. It's a smash and grab moment in history. And so as part of that, there's this real sort of sense that that anything that we try and do to stop that is kind of helpless. Any protests that we put up, be it, you know, sort of the Occupy movements of the 2011, 12, I think they were happening, contemporary protests today or protests against the war in Iraq, any of these protests, wherever they happen in the world, just don't seem to be working. Governments don't seem to be interested in listening. And so protest itself has become somewhat kind of like impotent. And I don't know whether people are kind of like consciously recognizing this, but at some level, protest has become part of like performance and play. And I suppose because, you know, all of reality is becoming increasingly playful and increasingly gamified and as a way of distracting ourselves from the harsher realities that I've just articulated, people are much happier to sort of be in game spaces and to think about things in game rhetorics, game vernaculars. So it makes sense that activisms and protest movements would also have these game-like elements, and that does seem to be happening. I mean, there are a whole range of reasons why people are taking to game spaces to protest. I mean, you know, like one of the protests that I was looking at recently was the a whole lot of Malaysian children were protesting the bombings in Gaza. And it makes sense that this would happen because, I mean, you know, this is children in Malaysia, like Muslim children, who are really aware a lot of children are dying and their parents have said, you know, you can't go out onto the streets and protest. So they're protesting in spaces that they recognize because they feel, well, we're being killed. My demographic as a Muslim child is being killed and I want to protest against it. And I think, you know, that's sort of one example of how video games are, game spaces are allowing for protests to occur. But, you know, with the Hong Kong protests as well, there was, and I don't want to distract from the fact that, you know, there were physical protests happening in the streets in Hong Kong, like really quite, I mean, it was at least in the West. There's been a lot of protests in France, across Europe, in the US and in Australia and in a lot of places. But the protests in Hong Kong were actually, they made mainstream news in the West in the way that a lot of other protest movements didn't and haven't. So I probably don't need to tell you too much about the protests that took place. But a lot of those protests had kind of like gamified elements to them and used game vernaculars and game spaces. And I mean, one of the protests that I was sort of a little bit heartened by in some ways was it took place in the servers of Grand Theft Auto 5, which is to say there's mainland Chinese players playing Grand Theft Auto 5, and then a whole lot of Hong Kong players dressed their avatars in the sort of costume or uniform of the Hong Kong protester, like with the all black and the gas mask and the yellow helmet and the goggles, and then stormed into the Chinese servers of Grand Theft Auto and started smashing things up and turning police cars over and setting fire to them, which was kind of interesting because, I mean, what they were doing was symbolically destroying a mainland Chinese space. But within the kind of formula of the game, that's actually what you're supposed to do in Grand Theft Auto is, you know, like it's an open world, smash everything up space. And then, of course, a whole lot of mainland Chinese players responded in kind by fighting against the invading Hong Kong players in this space. And it sort of blurred that weird line between like violence and play. But it did so in a way where nobody actually got hurt or killed. And, you know, so there, I found something. I'm still trying to unravel that event and the meanings around it. But there was something hopeful in that expression of violence, that people were able to kind of bleed these sorts of, you know, will for destruction and violence in an online space where it's actually set up for that. And so, yeah, all of this sort of like libidinal violent energy for antagonism and protest was all the steam was released in that online space, and kind of nobody really got hurt. And there's something I do like about that, that those energies can be expelled in a way where at the end of it, you know, there a possibility for discussion arises, because ultimately a whole lot of people are in the same space together. I also do think it's worth recognizing these movements and the way they're expressing themselves. And, you know, controversially, I do think of QAnon as an activist movement. I don't share their concerns, I think, which is to say, you know, like I do recognize that a lot of their concerns are that, you know, they detect that things are going wrong with the political representation system and with sort of like the global economic order, in that they don't feel represented. And even though it's not sort of articulated specifically in that way, you can kind of see that that's undergirding the QAnon movement. And I guess with so many conspiracy theories, they really get very close to the truth. You know, this idea of like there's power shifting beneath the surface, and you know that it's affecting you for the worst, but quite often the ways that you have of diagnosing it are wrong. And I think that's true with QAnon, that there's probably a lot of things that individually and collectively I probably do have a similar take on the world to maybe some of the individuals in QAnon, which is that like something broken at the heart of things. But yeah, their methods of diagnosis I take issue with. But the way that these movements more broadly, the way they're expressing themselves is increasingly kind of gamified and ludified. And, you know, play is a really important subjectivity through which these things are being performed. So yeah, it's a kind of a much broader area. And having said all of that, I think that games are also a really good method or lens for looking at these things. I mean, you know, that's what I do with my own work, is I use games as a method or a lens for kind of looking at QAnon. QAnon is not specifically games culture, although I argue that it is. But I think that games offer a really useful lens of opening up that phenomenon. With QAnon, there are very specific reasons from its like genealogy point of view, which is to say that, you know, a lot of the people caught up in QAnon did kind of begin in Gamergate. And a lot of those people ended up in sort of these game forums, these sort of playful forums, these dark humor forums of 4chan and 8chan, in which games were discussed and game vernacular was used. I think more broadly, games are structures and play is the movement that happens within them. And so in looking at structures, I think that games are really kind of like useful metaphor and logic for kind of like apprehending and understanding them and trying to sort of untangle the motivations of people playing in those spaces. And, you know, people are playing whether they realize it or not in a lot of these instances. That's quite a layered discussion as well, of like people who are playing who don't know, realize they're playing. And people who are kind of played, who don't realize they're being played, that they're part of a game. And, you know, this is a really important part of the issue that I take with gamification, is that, you know, we do live in a gamified world increasingly, and yet a lot of people don't know it. Like it's not announced, you know, sort of we're all part of this capitalist economy. which is very much a game structure of point scoring. And but we're all kind of being played or participating in this dark play where it's not really announced as a game, but it has a game structure to it. And if you're good at playing the game, if you sort of research the game and find out what the rules are, and then are ruthless in your play, you can do really well in it. So yeah, games thinking, I think, can be very useful in this moment for that reason.
One of the things I really appreciated about that interview with Hugh is how compassionate he is towards the conspiracy fantasists that he's describing. And I appreciate the way that he's able to do that while not being uncritical of their position. As I was mentioning in the intro, my association with Hugh and his work came from a project I was doing with my colleagues Aris Komporosos Athanasiou and A.T. Kingsmith around conspiracy games and counter games. And one of the things that led us to that project and continued to frustrate us when we were in that project is so many people who are studying conspiracies and conspiracy worlds sort of begin with the premise that anyone who believes in a conspiracy theory must be either deranged or stupid. And in fact, what we learned and what many people who study conspiracy theories and conspiracy fantasies learn is that, sure, I mean, like any system of belief, there are some people who are deranged and some people who are not particularly intelligent, or at least don't apply their intelligence to their particular theory. But there are plenty of people who, in fact, are both quite thoughtful and quite reasonable and even quite compassionate and apply all of those things to their concern about the conspiracy they see at work in the world. And in fact, many conspiracy fantasists and theorists begin from a position that I think most listeners to this podcast would probably admire, which is that there is power on Earth. People with power exercise it. People with power often exercise that power in the shadows, secretly. They do so in what can legitimately be called conspiracies, in the sense that they get together behind closed doors and try and shape reality through their collaborations. And that, in fact, many of these conspiracies are quite influential over people's lives and over politics around the world. Now, the problem that we identified, and I think from what Hugh said, Hugh might agree, is that what I just described sounds like people who have an analysis of power in society, and we all should have an analysis of power. But what goes wrong, I think, in the thing that we've come to associate with conspiracies and conspiracy theories is a difference between what we ended up calling like a charismatic theory of power and a systemic theory of power. And very briefly, a charismatic theory of power is when you see all of these terrible things going on in the world and you say, aha, there must be a person or a set of individuals working together who are responsible for this. And those individuals must be evil. Like they must be motivated either at best by greed or at worst by Satan or the devil or some evil force. And the alternative is to look at the terrible things that are happening in the world and say, well, these are happening because generally well-meaning people are conscripted by systems of power. And systems of power conscript all of us in small or large ways and influence our behavior. And sometimes they conscript the behavior of powerful rich people. And sometimes the powerful rich people work together. But those powerful rich people are not always even aware of how they are reproducing the system that enriched them or made them powerful. And they're sometimes not aware of how their actions are going to deleteriously involve lots of other people. So there are real conspiracies of the rich and the powerful, and they are influential. But what's much more important to grasp from our perspective is how systems of power work, and that it's not just sort of evil individuals. It's actually these systems working together. And I think when you start to see that, you come to a position that's much closer to the one that I feel like Hugh articulated in our interview, which is like we have to actually have some patience and thoughtfulness and in a certain way respect and understanding for people who do proverbially fall down the rabbit hole and not accept those ideas, but also not presume just because those ideas are unconventional or disturbing, or indeed the ideas themselves might be slightly deranged, if not the individuals, that people come to them for a lot of different reasons. Naomi Klein, in her new book, Doppelganger, says that, you know, conspiracy theories get the feelings right and the facts wrong. And I think there's something really important to remember. And it was that sort of tone and that balance that I really appreciated in this interview with Hugh.
Yeah, thank you. I love that you touched on the compassionate angle of his research, because that was also something I really noted. And yeah, I think what's really important to remember when we're listening to Hugh is that the communities that he's describing that come about as a result of people engaging with this game are just a micro study in how these structures influence play. And none of us are immune to whatever structures we've been indoctrinated into. And I think that idea will lead really nicely into our next interview, where we're actually talking to one of the historians of game theory, which, right, if the QAnon conspiracy is this tiny microcosm of a destructive worldview at play, then talking with Dr. Sonia Amadei will get us ready to examine the worldview that all of us have been essentially baked into.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also a really great example, Sonia Amadei's work, of how something like game theory, which has become so influential in ways that I'll describe in a moment, emerged from many different individuals working independently or only in semi-collaboration. And the mistake would be to say, the enthrallment of the world and, you know, almost every economics department and political science department and all of the people who go through those departments to a certain idea of game theory is the result of some nefarious conspiracy to, dominate the world. But in fact, I think what Amadei's work shows us is that, in fact, these things are more emergent, and they emerge from a certain set of push and pull factors and competition over the ideas that will describe our world to us. So very briefly, for listeners who haven't heard of it, game theory developed starting before the Second World War, but really in the 1950s and onward, as a kind of paradigm for thinking about zero-sum games between individuals. So the classic one that, and the most famous one that Amadei will speak about in our next episode, is the prisoner's dilemma. You might have heard of this one before. The idea is that there are two prisoners who are, say, engaged in a rebellion against a repressive state, and they're both arrested at the same time and held in isolation from one another. And their captors come into the cell and says to each of them individually, look, if you confess and your partner confesses, your collaborator confesses, then we're going to give you both a long and horrible sentence. And if neither of you confess, we're going to give you an even longer and even more horrible sentence. But if your collaborator confesses and you rat your collaborator out, if you defect, to use the words of game theory, then you are going to have a very short sentence and they're going to have a very long sentence. And the idea is that with this kind of fairly kind of ridiculous paradigm, you can begin to mathematically chart out what rational choices are. And what Amadei does in her fabulous book, Prisoners of Reason, which she'll be talking about next episode, it shows us how this strange paradigm of reducing human behavior to a sort of competitive deception really took over the world. To begin with, it began to recalibrate the U.S. government's approach to nuclear war and nuclear weapons, moving away from a kind of paradigm of mutually assured destruction to one that actually was based on the idea that the United States could win a thermonuclear war that might wipe out most of humanity, but was still a strategic victory was still possible. It moved from there to becoming incredibly influential in economics and has become, in fact, like dominant in economics, so that most people who are working in economics in both the public and private sector have really built a lot of their thinking on this. Also political scientists and neoliberal statecraft, moving towards an idea that everyone in society is just an acquisitive cheat who is ready to betray the system at any moment. And the only role of government is to kind of repress people's baser instincts and ensure a functional market society. And it even became central to some new thinking about evolutionary biology via Richard Dawkins, and later to the thinking of Silicon Valley itself, which, of course, has been so influential over the last 20 years over things like social media, computing, And now, of course, the future of artificial intelligence, which is also often built based on this completely, well, it's a very narrow and very jaundiced view of human nature. And I think the importance to tie these two episodes together is that, you know, Hugh gives us a view of what it's like to live in a world where you feel you're constantly being played, where there's a game that's going on outside of you that you can't control and that you really can't win, but that you are forced to play nevertheless. And I think what Amadei shows us in her book and what we'll be looking at next episode is what that kind of invisible game might be. Again, it's not a conspiracy, but if we admit that many of today's most influential public and private institutions are really built on thinking that is heavily indebted to game theory and the prisoner's dilemma, then we have to admit that the world has been built in the image of a game. And that, I think, helps us really understand what's at stake in thinking about this podcast's theme, the exploits of play, and what we might need to do to craft different forms of resistance to it.
Weird Economies is sponsored by the Canada Council for the Arts. You can listen to the whole podcast as well as view the transcript at weirdeconomies.com. Thank you so much for listening.